a pat on the left pants pocket for his car keys, the right pants pocket for his cell, left breast for his gun, and right rear pants pocket for his wallet. Everything was in place. Brian was leaning on the Buick's hood, left hand pressed against the chipped brown paint.
Bri, you okay?
Brian shrugged.
Might be coming down with something.
That would be the day.
Dude, you never get sick.
Brian looked up. Beneath his shaggy dark red hair, his face looked a bit pale.
You don't feel anything, Pooks?
Other than guilt at hogging most of the universe's available supply of awesome, no, I'm fine. You think you caught something at the Maloney site?
Maybe,
Brian said. Even if Brian had caught something, they'd been there only a few hours ago. Flu didn't set in that fast. Maybe Brian was just tired. Most days, the guy hid in his darkened apartment like some nocturnal creature. 3 day shifts in a row had probably played havoc with Brian's sleep patterns. They walked down Union toward the corner of Mason Street. There lay the Trattoria Contadina restaurant. According to Tryon's info, one Pete the fucking Jew Goldblum had been seen there several times.
Bri, know what's bugging me?
That Polyester Rich has our case.
You're psychic,
Pookie said.
You should be one of those fortune tellers.
Just leave it alone.
Like hell Pookie would leave it alone. Why would the chief want her best two inspectors off the Maloney case? It just didn't make any sense. Maybe it had something to do with whatever was under that blue tarp. Paul Maloney had deserved a lot of bad things, but not murder. His end couldn't be considered justice, no matter what crimes he'd committed. Maloney had been tried and convicted by a jury of his peers. The court's punishments had not included the death sentence. Brian coughed, then spit a nasty glob of yellow phlegm onto the sidewalk.
Lovely, Pookie said. Maybe you are sick.
Maybe,
Brian said.
You should be a detective or something.
They passed San Francisco Evangelical Church. After arriving from Chicago 10 years ago, Pookie had given that one a whirl. Not his taste. He tried several churches before finding his home at Glide Memorial. Pookie preferred his sermons served up with a side of soul music and a touch of R&B. He realized he was walking alone. He looked back. Brian was standing there, his face in his hands, slowly moving his head side to side like he was trying to shake away a thought.
Bri, are you sure you're okay?
Brian looked up, blinked. He cleared his throat, let loose another goober rocket, then nodded.
Yeah, I'm fine. Let's go.
Trattoria Contadina was only a block away from Washington Square. Concierges knew the restaurant and sent tourists there to dine, but for the most part the place belonged to the locals. Simple white letters on a dingy green, bird-crap-strewn awning spelled out the corner restaurant's name along both Union and Mason. A bell over the door rang as Brian and Pookie walked inside. The smell of meat, sauce, and cheese smacked Pookie in the face. He'd forgotten about the place and made a mental note to come back soon for dinner. The eggplant antipasti was so good you'd slap your sister to get some, and Pookie liked his sister. About half of the linen-covered tables were full, couples and groups talking and laughing to the accompaniment of clinking silverware. Pookie was about to pull out the pictures Tryon had provided when Brian lightly elbowed him, then nodded toward the back corner. It took Pookie a second to recognize the half-lidded eyes of Pete Goldblum, who was sitting with two other men. Pookie walked to the table. Brian followed, just a step behind. That was the way they handled things. Even though Brian was smaller, he was kind of the heavy of the partnership. Pookie did most of the talking until the time for talking had passed. Then Brian took over. The Terminator had a coldness about him that people couldn't ignore. Pookie stopped at the table.
Peter Goldblum!
All three men looked up with that stare, the one that said, "We know you're a cop, and we don't fucking like cops." They all wore suits. That was unusual. The era of the well-dressed mafioso had largely passed by. Nowadays, dressing flashy was for gangbangers. Most of the really powerful guys dressed as inconspicuously as possible. Goldblum finished chewing a mouthful of food and swallowed it down.
Who's asking?
I'm Inspector Chang.
Pookie showed his badge. He tilted his head toward Brian.
This is Inspector Clouser. We're with Homicide, looking into the murder of Teddy Ablamowitz.
Brian walked around to the other side of the table. The three men watched him, their attention naturally drawn to the more dangerous-looking of the two cops. The man sitting opposite Goldblum spoke.
Clouser? As in Brian Clouser?
Pookie recognized the other two men just as Brian answered. The arrogant face of Frank Lanza. The broad shoulders and shaved head of Tony Gillum. Brian nodded.
That's right, Mr. Lanza. I'm surprised you know my name.
Lanza shrugged.
Someone told me about you. From what I hear, you're in the wrong line of work. You should be one of those...
He squinted and looked to the ceiling, pretending to try and remember something.
Tony, what's the name of those guys they have in those silly gangster movies? The guys who kill people?
Hitmen,
Tony said. He spoke with a voice so deep that he might very well have the four balls of his nickname.
You should be a hitman, Mr. Lanza.
Right,
Lanza said.
A hitman, that's it.
He looked at Brian.
I heard you killed, what, four people?
Brian nodded.
So far.
The one-liner made the men pause. Damn, Pookie had to write that one down for later. That kind of stuff could make a script sing.
Mr. Goldblum, Pookie said, we'd like to ask you some questions about Teddy Ablamowitz.
Never met him,
Goldblum said.
He's the guy in the paper.
Lanza laughed.
He's in three papers, if you know what I mean. Parts of them, anyway. At least that's what I heard.
Lanza picked up a piece of bread and smeared it in the sauce on his plate. He shook his head dismissively, as if Pookie and Brian were a trivial annoyance that had to be temporarily tolerated. Were these guys for real? The suits, all of them together, in public like this, in an Italian restaurant? Maybe they had been quiet for 6 months, but stealth seemed to be over. They wanted people to see them, to know that the LCN was back in town.
This ain't Jersey, Pookie said. I don't know how you run things back east, but maybe you don't understand who Ablamowitz was working for, or what happens now.
Brian stared at Lanza, then picked up a piece of bread and took a bite.
He means you should lie low, Mr. Lanza. Not be out like this, where anyone can roll up on you.
Lanza shrugged.
We're just out for a meal. We didn't do nothing wrong. You think we did something wrong?
Brian smiled. The smile was even spookier than his stare.
Doesn't matter what I think, he said. What matters is what Fernando Rodriguez thinks. Who the fuck is Fernando Rodriguez?
It took Pookie a second to realize that Lanza wasn't making a joke. Maybe God loved Frank Lanza, because it had to be a miracle that an idiot like this had lived so long.
He's the boss of the Norteños, Pookie said. Locally, anyway. You should know these things. Fernando is a man who gets things done, Mr. Lanza. If he thinks you were involved with the Ablamowitz murder, odds are you guys are going to have visitors. Real soon.
Goldblum picked his napkin out of his lap and dropped it on his half-eaten dinner.
Fuck that,
he said quietly.
I'm a tax-paying citizen. Think I'm concerned about some chicken-shit wetback outfit?
Oh, man, these guys hadn't done their homework. Underestimating the Norteños could win you an express ticket to the morgue. Pookie felt compelled to bring Pete in, for his own safety more than for the crime.
Mr. Goldblum, Pookie said, I think you should come with us.
Goldblum's eyebrows raised, but his eyes stayed half-lidded.
You arresting me, Gook?
Pookie shook his head.
I'm from Chicago, not Vietnam.
And no, we're not arresting you, but why make things difficult?
You know we're going to have that conversation downtown sooner or later, so let's just play nice and get it over with.
Lanza laughed.
Yeah, right. Like you guys are so different from East Coast cops. You never get it over with.
Pookie heard the tingle of the front door's bell. Brian's eyes snapped up, then narrowed.
Uh-oh.
Pookie turned quickly. Two Latino men, approaching fast. Thick workingman jackets, knit hats.
one red with the white N of the Nebraska Cornhuskers, the other red with the SF logo of the 49ers. Tats peeked out from their T-shirt collars, running right up to their ears. Each man had a hand in his jacket. Each man was staring at Frank Lanza. Jesus H. Christ, a hit? Here?
Books, Brian said quietly. Get back here. Now.
Pookie stepped around the table before reaching into his jacket for his Sig Sauer, but the men were faster. Their hands came out of their jackets, one raising a semi-auto, the other leveling a sawed-off pump shotgun. Before the men even cleared their weapons, Brian drew his own Sig with his left hand, reached out and grabbed Lanza with his right. In the same motion, he kicked the table over so the top faced the gunman, sending plates of food flying. Brian shoved Lanza down behind the overturned table. The sawed-off roared, shredding linen and splintering wood. Brian's pistol barked twice. Bam, bam! The shotgun guy twitched. Then Brian fired for the third time in less than a second. The man's head rocked back, and he dropped. Screams filled the air. Pookie found his gun in his shaking hand. The other attacker backpedaled for the front door, firing wildly toward the table. Pookie aimed. People on the floor, ducking behind tables. Too crowded, traffic outside, people on the sidewalk, but didn't fire. A gunshot to Pookie's right, Tony Gillum, firing as the perp ran out the restaurant door. Brian came at Tony from behind, grabbing Tony's right hand and lifting it, pointing the gun to the ceiling even as Brian drove his left foot into the back of Tony's right leg. Tony grunted and fell to his knee. Brian twisted sharply, throwing the bigger man face down onto the food-strewn linoleum floor. Brian remained standing, Tony's gun still in his hand. He ejected the magazine and pulled back the slide, then walked four steps forward and kicked the sawed-off shotgun away from the downed gunman.
Pooks, cuff Tony and call us in.
The fear finally hit home. It had all gone down in 4 seconds, five at most. Pookie pointed his weapon just to the left of Tony's back.
Don't move! Hands behind your head!
Relax,
Tony said as he obliged.
I got a permit.
Pookie set his knee into the small of Tony's back, making the man carry his weight.
Just stay right there! Brian, you going after the other gunman?
No way, Brian said. We wait for backup. First gotta peek his head out that door, might get it shot off.
He then shouted to the restaurant patrons.
San Francisco police, everyone just stay where you are. Is anyone hurt?
The patrons looked at one another. Waited for someone to talk. No one did. A chorus of shaking heads answered Brian's question.
Okay, he said. Nobody move until backup arrives. Stay down. Stay calm. Do not try to leave the building. The gunman might still be outside.
10 seconds of panic had rooted the patrons in place. They didn't relax, not even close, but they obediently stayed put. As Pookie cuffed Tony Gillum, Brian knelt next to the would-be assassin and opened the man's jacket. Glancing over, Pookie saw two spreading red spots staining the perp's white T-shirt, blood circles merging into a solid figure eight. Blood also oozed from a spot just under the man's left nostril. Two to the chest, one to the head. Pookie called for backup. He also requested an ambulance, but unless someone got a splinter from the ruined table, the paramedics wouldn't have much to do. Brian's perp was already dead.
Holy shit!
Lanza said.
Holy shit!
Brian sighed, closed the gunman's jacket. He looked back at Lanza.
They were after you, Lanza. Like I told you, you probably want to lie low, if not just throw in the towel and go back to Jersey.
A wide-eyed Lanza nodded.
Yeah, lie low.
Brian walked to Lanza and helped the man to his feet.
You owe me,
Brian said. Pookie watched. Brian had just killed a man, yet he acted like that was about as upsetting as opening the fridge to find someone had drunk the last of the milk. The casual nature and the cold stare seemed to shake Lanza up as much as the shooting itself.
You owe me,
Brian said again.
You know that, right?
Lanza rubbed his face, then nodded.
Yeah, I... Holy shit, man!
A name, Brian said. We want a name for the Sablamowitz thing.
Lanza looked back to the dead gunman lying on the floor at Brian's feet, then nodded. Pete Goldblum had hit the deck as soon as the shooting started. He stood and wiped spaghetti sauce off his suit coat.
Mr. Lanza, you don't know this cop shit.
Shut up, Pete, Lanza said. I'd be a grease spot right now.
You and Four Balls didn't do a goddamn thing.
Hey,
said a face-down Tony Gillum.
I got a round off.
Sure, Tony, Lanza said. You're like a regular Green Beret.
Pookie heard his own long release of breath before he knew he was letting it out. The situation was contained. It wasn't the first time he'd seen Brian Clauser in action like that, but he hoped it would be the last. Chapter 7. Brian's Lie. The sun had hidden itself somewhere behind the apartment buildings. Brian was only minutes away from his bed and sleep. Usually he had trouble sleeping at night, but not today. He'd be out like a light.
Riddle me something, Bri-Bri!
Brian's forehead rested in his right hand. His elbow rested on the inside handle of Pookie's Buick. Whatever bug he had was rapidly getting worse. Fatigue and body aches, the start of sniffles, throat full of razor blades, the first hint at a monster headache. Brian leaned back and yawned. Pookie had been talking nonstop since they left the restaurant. That was in a manual somewhere. Keep the shooter talking after the incident. Don't give him time to get all introspective. Pookie meant well, for sure, but Brian just wanted silence. He couldn't tell his friend and partner why. Some things you just couldn't share. They were almost back to Brian's apartment. Then he'd be done with Pookie's constant chatter.
Bri-Bri, you hearing me?
Yeah. Sure. What's the question?
How does a grown man not have a car?
Brian had to clear his throat before he could talk.
Don't need a car. I live right in the city.
You don't need a car because I schlep you all over the place.
Also a factor.
Pookie double-parked in front of Brian's building. Horns behind them started honking instantly.
Bri-Bri, you going to be okay? I can hang here tonight if you want.
Brian put on his best fake solemn expression.
Thanks, but no, this ain't my first rodeo. I just need to be alone and think this through.
Pookie nodded.
All right, playa, but call me if you start wigging out, okay?
Thanks, man.
Brian had to coax his exhausted body out of the car. He stumbled into his building. What a day. A shooting, handling the crime scene, giving his statement, the preliminary shooting review. Too damn much. There would be more long days to come. With all those witnesses, with a gunman opening fire in a crowded restaurant, Brian wouldn't catch any shit for this. That didn't mean, however, that he didn't have to go through the motions. A full shooting review board was already scheduled. That was always such a good time. And at the crime scene itself, before he could even leave, there'd been the mandatory chat with the police shrink. Was Brian okay? How did the shooting make him feel? Did he think he could be alone that night? Brian said what he always said, that killing a man felt awful. And as always, that was a lie. Did he enjoy killing people? No. Did he feel bad about it? Not in the least. He knew that he should feel something, but just like the last four times, he did not. The guy had fired a shotgun. If Brian hadn't put him down, it could have been Lanza in the body bag. Or Pookie. Or Brian himself. Lanza. Such an idiot. Maybe on the East Coast, people respected the Mafia enough to give them leeway, but not out here. Jimmy the Hat had been a sharp cat. His son? Not so much. Frank and his buddies dressed up like they wanted the golden age of crime to come back overnight. Well, now they knew a different story. Adrenaline had kept Brian pumped from the shooting right up through the talk with the shrink. But during that whole time, his body had been sneakily breaking down. Once the buzz of excitement wore off, he'd felt completely wiped out. Brian pressed the button to call the rickety old elevator. Instead of a click and the whir of machinery, he heard nothing. Damn it, the elevator was broken again. He pushed his body up the stairs, each step feeling like he was lifting someone else's much larger foot. He reached the fourth floor and paused. Muscle pain you could ignore,
most of it anyway. Aches, throbbing, fever. But now he felt a new pain that demanded his attention. A pain in the chest. Brian ground his teeth, then rubbed his hand hard against his sternum. Was he having a heart attack? No. It felt like it was a little above his heart. But what did he know about heart attacks? Maybe that's where they started. And then, suddenly, the pain faded away. He took a long, deep breath. Maybe he should call a doctor, but he was so damn tired. It was probably nothing. Just the flu messing with his system. Maybe he was more stressed about the shooting than he knew. If his chest felt like that the next day, he'd call a doc for sure. Brian walked into his apartment and started stripping off his weapons. He managed to remove most of his clothes before he crashed into his bed and fell asleep on top of his covers. Chapter 8. Fade In, Fade Out. The musty dampness of rotting cloth, the stench of rancid garbage, the pulsing heat of the hunt. Two conflicting emotions fighting for dominance. The overpowering electric taste of hatred, juxtaposed against the pinching, tingling sensation of creeping evil. Even as he hunted, something hunted him. Brian stood motionless, using only his eyes to track the prey.
One womb.
They hurt him, just like the other one had.
We have waited so long.
Even through the blurry, nonsensical images, he recognized the street, Van Ness. Shifty streaks of people with indiscernible, blurred faces, moving swaths of fuzzy color that were cars, headlights and streetlights that made the fog glow. Brian watched his target, a target made up of abstract impressions of hazy crimson and dull gold, of wide shoulders and floppy blonde hair, of scowling eyes made of evil. Not a man, a boy. Big, but still young. The boy had a certain walk, a certain scent. Brian wanted this boy dead. He wanted them all dead.
One womb.
Hunting, but also hunted. Brian searched the skyline, looking for movement. Even as he did, he felt a deep, cold knowledge that he probably wouldn't see death coming. He needed to make the mark that kept the monster at bay. Brian felt a tap on his shoulder. He sighed in frustration, knowing he could take the prey if only there weren't so many people around. But he had another job to do. This target would have to wait. Turning now, moving, everything a blur, fade in, fade out, refocused. Looking down at an alley, must be high up. Looking down at a beat-up blue dumpster. Something behind the dumpster, mostly hidden from view, but not hidden from smell. Brian recognized this scent as well. Not as good as the boy, not as healthy, more worn out, but still good enough to make his stomach rumble. Brian looked closer, a bit of red and yellow behind the dumpster. A blanket, a red blanket. The yellow looked like something familiar, a little bird. Fade out, fade in, fade out again. The dream slipped away. In his bed, Brian turned once, opened his eyes and wondered where he was. The room's darkness seemed a living thing, ready to sting him with blackened barbs. Sweat dripped from his face, soaked into his sheets. His sheets. His bed. He was in his own apartment. He'd left the dream, but the fear of the monster that hunted him came along for the ride. His chest hurt, far worse than it had on the stairs. Was that ache from dream terror, or from the flu that made him burn and sweat? Brian reached out and turned on his nightstand lamp. He winced at the sudden light, but not for long. He had to find some paper, find a pen. He had to draw. Chapter 9. Rex Wakes Up. Rex Dubrovtichuk woke up hot and sweating, excited, terrified.
For a brief moment he remained lost in the dream's power, his heart hammering, his breath short and fast. Then the aches faded back in like a vice slowly squeezing every part of his body. The pain, the fever. He'd never been this sick before. His pants felt funny. He reached down and touched, felt something stiff. He pulled his hand back. What was that down there? Embarrassment swept over him, making his skin feel even hotter. He had a boner. He knew what boners were, of course. Kids at school talked about them all the time. People talked about them on TV. He'd even seen them in internet porn. Seen them, sure, but he'd never had one. Watching porn hadn't given him one. Neither had the girls at school. Rex had always known he was supposed to have them, yet they had never come. Nothing had ever turned him on before. But the dream had. He had been stalking Alex Panos, the biggest of the bullies who made Rex's life hell. Stalking him, like a lion would stalk a zebra. The dream's smells still filled Rex's nose. Rotting cloth, garbage, and those conflicting feelings. Burning rage against the bully, and mind-numbing fear of the thing lurking in the shadows. One womb. What a great dream. He'd almost jumped down from some building to attack that asshole Alex. Wouldn't that have been great? There had been other people in the dream. People who were hunting side by side with him. Two people. Two people with strange faces. Dreams were crazy like that. His dick throbbed so bad it hurt. It was a different kind of hurt than the sickness that overwhelmed his body. Growing pains, Roberta had told him. He still didn't know about that. The pains had come out of nowhere just a couple of days ago. But maybe she was right. He'd just had his first boner ever, so maybe he was growing. Maybe he'd grow a lot and wouldn't be the smallest freshman in the school anymore. Maybe. Maybe he'd get big enough to beat up the bullies. The boner brought with it a huge wave of relief. In that way, at least, he was like the other boys. Rex climbed out of bed, careful to move quietly lest the squeaky floorboards wake his mother. If Roberta woke up at this hour, it would be real bad. He reached up and tenderly touched his nose, still sore. That wasn't from the body aches. It was from where Alex had punched him in the face yesterday. Just a little punch, and it had put Rex down. If Alex ever hit Rex as hard as he could. Rex didn't want to think about that. He walked to his desk and turned on his lamp. He had to draw a symbol he'd seen in the dream, something that he knew would make the fear fade away. He'd draw the symbol, and then something else, one of those strange faces he'd seen in the dream, a face that should have frightened him, but did not. Finally, Rex would draw Alex. Alex, and all the things Rex wished he could do to him. The sketch pad waited. Rex drew.
Chapter 10. Aggie James, Duckies, and Bunnies. Aggie James pulled the dirty sleeping bag tighter around his body. Even the two cardboard boxes underneath him couldn't keep away the ground's chill. He'd wedged himself behind a dumpster that blocked at least some of the light wind. But San Francisco's night mist permeated his clothes, saturated every breath he drew into his lungs, even soaked into the sleeping bag he'd been so lucky to find. The sleeping bag was red, with duckies and bunnies on it. He'd found it draped over a trash can not too far from here. He felt the cold, the dampness, but those were distant, just faint echoes of something that might concern him. Weather didn't matter, because he had scored. Scored big. And it was good shit, too. He'd felt the horse kick in before he'd even pulled the syringe out of his arm. This was his favorite sleeping spot, in the back doorway of some old furniture store on Fern Street, just off Van Ness. They called it a street, but it was an alley. No one really bothered him here. A numbing warmth spread all over his body, even down to his toenails. Man, even down to his toenails. So it was cold out. So what? Aggie was warm in the way he needed to be warm. He heard a light thump, then a heavier rattle, like something had landed on the dumpster.
Pierre, you retard. Try to be quiet.
You shut up.
The first voice sounded raspy, like sandpaper on rough wood. The second rang deep, deep and slow. The sounds echoed through Aggie's head. He hoped these guys would just pass on by. Sleep was coming whether he wanted it or not. Damn, but this was some good shit.
This him?
The sandpaper voice.
Uh-huh,
said a third voice. This one sounded high-pitched.
We gotta clean him up, but for sure he's a won't-be.
The sound of someone sniffing, and that sound was close. When Aggie heard it, he felt a cool trickle of air across his cheek. Was someone smelling him? Aggie tried to open his eyes. They cracked, just a little. He saw a blurry image of a kid's head. Maybe a teenager? The teenager smiled. Aggie's eyes slid shut, returning him to the delicious darkness. Had he dropped a tab? Maybe he had after he shot up, then forgot about it. Had to be something. Horse had never made him hallucinate before. Well, maybe a little, but not like that. Had to be acid. Only acid could have made him see that teenager with big black eyes, skin as purple as grape juice, and a smiling mouth full of big fucking shark teeth. Just say no to hallucinations. Thank you very much.
I've been watching him,
said the high-pitched voice.
He looks sick,
said the deep voice. Something about that voice, something wet and slurry. It reminded Aggie of Sylvester, the cat from Looney Tunes, the way he'd spit and slobber while working out thuffering fuckatash. The guy sounded like he had a tongue that just didn't know its place.
He's not sick,
said High Pitch.
He looks sick.
Why?
You think he's sick?
I don't know,
said the sandpaper voice. High Pitch sounded offended.
He's not sick, he's just stoned. We can clean him up.
He better not be sick. The last one you picked must have had the flu. I shit chocolate milk for a week.
I said I was sorry about that,
sandpaper voice sighed.
Whatever. Pierre, pick him up. We need to get back.
Aggie felt strong arms slide under him, lift him effortlessly.
I'm staying out tonight. We have lots of time before dawn. I got to do my thing.
The sandpaper voice again.
Chomper, you need to come back with us.
No, the visions, I can sense him.
Yeah, so can we. I told you not to talk about it. You want Firstborn to beat you again.
No, I don't want that again. But those assholes hurt him. I can feel it.
Him. Whoever it was, he sounded important.
I have someone watching over him. You stay away, or you could bring the monster down on him.
A pause. Aggie felt like he weighed all of 5 pounds. Maybe even 5 negative pounds, because you don't weigh anything if you float.
I'll stay away, but I'm not going home. Not yet.
Just don't draw attention, and stay away from the king. Hillary said he's not ready yet. You get us caught, Firstborn will kill us. Pierre, let's go, we're due back.
Okay, Sly.
Aggie felt like he was falling, only for a second. Then he went up, so fast. Herky-jerky, pop, 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 like someone taking the stairs 3 at a time. Yet the arms holding him felt gentle, like the guy carrying him was being careful, much like you would be careful carrying a 12 eggs you just bought from the store. Aggie struggled to open his eyes again. He was on a rooftop. He could see Van Ness far below, his attention drawn to a green Starbucks sign. Not that a Starbucks sign was much of a landmark. Those things were everywhere. Then the world lurched under him, up, then down, then up, then down. Despite the motion, the horse, that goddamn fine horse, finally caught up with him. Aggie James let himself slide into the warmth and the darkness, into the one place where the memories didn't haunt him. Chapter 11. The Belt.
But I feel sick.
Roberta de Provdichuk crossed her arms and stared.
Get up, boy! You go to school!
The very word school did, in fact, make Rex feel sick. Sick inside, a cold sensation that made him want to crawl into a hole and hide forever.
Honest, I really don't feel good.
She rolled her eyes.
You think I was born yesterday? You're not sick. Those kids pick on you because you're obnoxious. You leave them alone, and they'll leave you alone. Get up and go to school, and no skipping. You skip school like some good-for-nothing burnout. Sit here and draw all day. I let you put your stupid pictures up on the walls, don't I? Now get up!
She grabbed the blankets and yanked them off. He had a horrid, frozen moment of exposure, of his boner pushing his underwear out in a little tent. Rex slammed his body into a fetal position, hands over his underwear-clad privates.
You filthy boy! Did you touch it?
Still curled up, he shook his head.
Rex, did you touch yourself? No.
He heard the familiar hiss of leather sliding through denim belt loops. He closed his eyes tight in anticipation of the pain to come.
Roberta, I didn't touch it. Honest, I...
The crack of leather on his back cut his words short.
You little liar!
A second crack, this time on his legs. Despite the stinging pain, he stayed curled up. Rex knew better than to cry out, or to try and get away.
I told you never to be like the other dirty boys, didn't I?
Crack. His shoulder lit up.
I'm sorry. I won't do it ever again.
Crack. On the thin underwear fabric covering his ass. That one made him lurch, twitch, his body screaming at him to run, but he fought himself back into a tight ball. If he ran or resisted, it would only get worse.
There,
Roberta said.
I'm helping you, Rex. You need to learn these things. If you're not ready for school in 5 minutes, you get more. You hear me talking to you?
She walked out, slamming the door behind her. The pain faded a little, but the cold feeling in his chest would not leave. He still had to go to school. Rex sat up on the bed. His boner had gone away. Roberta had always told him boners were bad, and the lingering stings on his back, his legs, his ass, told him she was right. He dreamed again, and this time he remembered more. He'd been watching Alex Panos, waiting for a chance to kill Alex. And that was what made Rex feel funny. Not girls, not even boys. The stalking gave him the boner. Hunting Alex felt exciting, arousing. But the dream also carried a dark fear that someone was watching Rex, waiting in the darkness to hurt him. Dream Rex had turned away from Alex. Instead, Rex and his friends had grabbed some random homeless guy. Grabbed him. Taken him. But taken him where? Rex couldn't remember. He stood. That fear, it sat in his stomach like a block of ice. It wouldn't go away. He picked his jeans up off the floor. As he slid them on, he looked over at his desk, at his latest drawing of Alex Panos and the bullies. The drawing wasn't finished. Maybe he could finish it in history class. Rex had read the whole textbook the first week of school and got 100% on every test. Mr. Garthus didn't care if Rex did any work, as long as he kept quiet. No time to finish the full drawing, but Rex felt an urge to sketch that symbol again. He had to sketch it. Right now. When his pencil completed the symbol's final half-circle, the lingering dream fear finally eased away. Rex's more familiar, ever-present anxiety remained, however. Roberta was wrong. It didn't matter if he minded his own business or not. The bullies would come for him no matter what he did. Rex shivered. He wanted to skip school, but he didn't dare. Whatever beating the bullies had for him, it couldn't match what Roberta would do if she switched from the belt to the paddle. Rex rubbed his new welts. He finished dressing. He gathered his books, then slid them, his pencils, and his art pad into his bag. Maybe today would be better. Chapter 12. The Drawing. Brian opened the Buick's door, moved Pookie's pile of folders, then sat.
Pooks, you ever clean out this crap-ass car?
Pookie leaned back, affected an expression of hurt.
My goodness, did someone wake up on the wrong side of the bed?
Brian shut the door. Pookie pulled into traffic.
I had some messed up dreams,
Brian said.
Couldn't sleep for shit.
That could explain why you look like the wet side of a half-dry dog turd.
Thanks.
Don't mention it. But seriously, folks, you do look awful. And trim that beard, man. You're starting to look like a gay hipster. I've no room for such nonsense in my life.
Brian's chest pain had faded from sharpness to a dull, nagging ache, like a jammed finger or a knot in his spine that refused to crack. He dug his right fist into his sternum and rubbed it around. Pookie looked over.
Heartburn?
Something like that.
Not sleeping, pale as a ghost, and chest pains to boot,
Pookie said.
If we weren't meeting Chief Zhao, I'd drive you back to your apartment and tell you to take a sick day.
Chief Zhao would already have the preliminary overview from the shooting review board. A full investigation was underway, standard procedure. But the early overview would determine if Brian stayed on normal duty or was relegated to a desk until the final report came in. There was also the option that Zhao could just suspend him altogether. For most cops, that wouldn't be a worry. Most cops, however, hadn't just killed their fifth human being.
I'll be okay,
Brian said, which was a lie. His fever had grown during the night. He felt hot all over. He was still a little dizzy, congested, and on top of that, the body aches were even worse. His knees and elbows, his wrists and ankles, all his joints felt like they were filled with gravel. His muscles throbbed with an entirely different feeling, as if someone had spent hours pummeling him with a meat tenderizer.
Don't breathe on me,
Pookie said.
You get me sick, I'm kicking you in the nuts. Tell me about these messed up dreams. Anything involving either a naughty cheerleader, detention with a malicious assistant principal, or a shy yet stacked nun questioning her life choices?
Brian laughed a short, choppy thing that drew a raspy cough.
I wish. Weren't those kind of dreams?
Nightmares.
Brian nodded.
Dreamed I was with a couple other guys. I don't know who they were. We were hunting this kid as he walked down Van Ness. And at the same time, something was hunting us. Something real bad, but I never saw it. Then we were going to do something to this old bum. I was still scared out of my gourd when I woke up. I had to draw something from the dream.
Brian pulled the sheet of paper out of his pocket, opened it and passed it to Pookie. Pookie looked at the image, an unfinished triangle with a circle slicing through the lines and under the points, a smaller circle in the center.
Wow,
Pookie said.
Your father and I are so proud, honey. We'll put it right on the fridge next to your report card. What is it?
No idea.
And what happened after you drew it?
Brian shrugged.
The fear went away. So did most of the dream. But I think I remember where the dream took place.
You recognize the spot?
Uh-huh. Pretty sure it was Van Ness and Fern.
Crazy. You want to check it out?
Brian shook his head.
We have to get to the chief's office.
We've got 15 minutes to spare,
Pookie said.
Come on, this could be good material for our cop show. I can see the log line now. An overstressed rebel cop can't escape nightmares of the hitman that got away.
I didn't dream about a hitman.
Dramatic license,
Pookie said.
Come on, Bri-Bri, this could be like a whole episode for me. Or even a 3-episode mini-arc, you in?
Brian remembered the crawling sense of creeping death, the fear that had gripped his stomach even as he descended on the bum. But he didn't feel that fear anymore. And besides, it was just a dream.
Sure, he said. Let's check it out.
Pookie changed lanes again. He left angry honks in his wake. And, as usual, he really didn't seem to care. Chapter 13 Van Ness and Fern. Brian looked around the alley. So damn familiar. Maybe he'd been here before. Had to have been here before. He couldn't know this place from a dream. Pookie lifted the lid of a beat-up blue dumpster and peeked inside. Seeing nothing of interest, he shut the lid, brushed off his hands, and adjusted his sunglasses. He kept looking around the alley.
So you saw a bum and some kid wearing crimson and gold?
Not sure, Brian said. The kid could have been crimson and gold. It was a dream, Pooks.
Yeah, but this is cool. Episode is practically writing itself. It's rare for a dreamer to think of a specific spot and not have to be some kind of connection.
And you know this because of your doctorate in dreamology?
Discovery Channel, asshole, Pookie said. There's more to life than reality TV.
Pookie pulled out his cell phone and checked the time.
All right, we better get rolling. Can't be late for your chit-chat with Zhao. Maybe the brother Steve already tracked down Jojo. The Steves find Oblomowitz's killer, and we go back on nights and can grab the Maloney case away from Polyester Rich.
Lanza had made good on Brian's demand for a name. That name? Joseph Jojo Lombardi, another of the guys who had come out from New Jersey. Brian and Pookie had immediately turned that info over to the brothers Steve. Was that Oblomowitz's actual killer? Brian couldn't say, but it was a lot more information than they'd had 24 hours ago.
Let's get out of here, Brian said. My stomach is a mess. If I have to smell that dumpster anymore, I'm going to blow chunks.
They walked out of the alley back to the Buick.
Pooks, you need to get with reality. Zhao won't give us the Maloney case.
The hell she won't!
Polyester Rich and Zhao go way back. I heard they both made Inspector about the same time.
Pookie got in and started the car.
Mark my words, young Brian Clauser. You and I will get this case, and when we do, we will nail Paul Maloney's murderer. I simply won't stand for P-freak vigilantes in my town.
Brian slid into the passenger seat. He looked back to the dumpster and saw something he'd missed. Underneath the dumpster, was that a blanket? A red blanket, with pictures of brown bunnies and yellow duckies. A little bird. As Pookie drove away, the nightmare's cold echo blossomed anew in Brian's memory. Brian took a breath, tried to forget about the blanket. He hadn't really dreamed about a red blanket with duckies and bunnies. He was just reverse imprinting or something. For now, he had more important things to worry about. Things like Chief Zhao's take on the shooting review board. But maybe, when that was done, Brian could find a quiet place to draw that weird picture again and make the cold feeling go away. Chapter 14 Boyko Rex ran. They were faster than him, but he ran anyway, hoping against hope that he could find a way out or a place to hide. Sometimes they got him. Sometimes they didn't. Every now and then he got lucky, made it to a street with lots of pedestrian traffic, saw a cop car or something else that would make his constant pursuers break off and wait for another chance. Today was not a lucky day. They'd been waiting for him after school. They knew which path he took to walk home. Sometimes he'd go 15 or 20 blocks out of his way, taking different random streets, but this time he just wanted to get back to his room. That fat, ugly meth head April Sanchez had seen his drawing. April bought her drugs from Alex. She was rich. Rex hated her. She'd recognized the people in the drawing and said she was going to tell Alex. Rex had known instantly that he was in major trouble. April wanted to be Alex's girlfriend. Something like the drawing was a chance to get Alex's attention. Rex had spent the last hour of school terrified, waiting for the bell to ring so he could get home fast. He should have gone away from his house, to one of his many hiding places, even to his favorite park. But in his fear, he'd taken the direct route home. Big mistake. He'd made it 2 blocks when he saw them, all 4 of them, on the corner of Francisco and Van Ness. Their crimson, gold, and white clothing stood out bright and clean in the afternoon sun. Rex instantly turned and ran back down Van Ness, past the football field, toward Aquatic Park. He should have run somewhere with more people, but he'd just run away. They chased him. They laughed. The 4 boys, always the same 4. Jay Parlar, Isaac Moses, Oscar Woody, and the worst of them all, Alex Panos. They caught him just past the parking lot that funneled the 2 divided 3-car lanes of Van Ness Avenue into a normal 2-lane road. An arm wrapped hard around his shoulders, a hand clamped over his mouth. The boys packed in close around him, carrying him. Rex tried to yell for help, but the hand was too tight. The bay was off to his right, the greenery sloping up to Fort Mason on his left, and no one was around. They carried him to the left, into a shady spot, and threw him down on a dirt patch. Rex tried to scramble up, but they surrounded him. Someone kicked him in the side, and he fell. They dragged him behind a utility van parked beneath an overhanging tree, out of sight from the mostly unused street. He wound up on his back. Someone hit him in the face, once, twice, 3 times. His nose buzzed with a numb, confusing pain. Tears filled his eyes, making everything look shimmery and fluid. He was dumb enough to call out for help. Then something hit him in the stomach, and all wind left his body. Someone sat on his chest, pinning him to the ground.
"I heard you were drawing fag pictures of me, you fucking faggot!"
Rex didn't need to see. He knew that voice. Alex Panos. A deep voice, far deeper than it should be for a sophomore in high school. But still it cracked on the first syllable of drawing. Rex tried to talk, to apologize, but he couldn't pull in enough air to speak.
"Hey, here's the drawing."
Jay Parlar's voice.
"Look at Alex. Hey, I'm in it. Watching you get your ass kicked. Wow, I look totally scared."
"Gimme," Alex said. Rex blinked away tears. He could see again. Oscar Woody was the one on his chest. Oscar's curly, poofy black hair stuck out from beneath a white baseball cap with a gold-lined crimson BC on the front. Above Oscar, standing there looking down, Alex Panos. Alex, with his movie star blonde hair and his big, strong body, a body that Rex would never have. Alex held an unfolded page from a sketch pad. He looked up. His eyes narrowed. He turned the drawing around so Rex could see it. Rex's drawings were getting pretty good. No mistaking that Alex was the boy in the drawing. The boy getting his arm cut off with a chainsaw held by a muscled version of Rex Dubrovtychuk. Alex smiled.
"So you think you can kill me, faggot?"
Rex shook his head, the back of his head grinding against dirt, twigs, and dried leaves. Jay peeked over Alex's shoulder. 16 years old, and Jay already had a goatee, although it was as thin and red as the hair on his head.
"Seriously, Alex, it's a good drawing. Looks just like you."
"Jay," Alex said.
"Shut the fuck up."
Jay's shoulders drooped. He seemed to suddenly shrink from a 5'10" stud to a 5'6" weakling.
"Sorry, Alex, I didn't mean nothing."
Alex's eyes never left Rex. Alex crumpled the paper, then tossed it aside.
"Boys," he said, "hold his arm."
Rex tried to scramble up, but Oscar was too heavy.
"Stay still, pussy,"
Oscar said. Someone grabbed Rex's right wrist and yanked it hard, painfully stretching his arm. Rex looked at this attacker, blue-eyed Isaac Moses, his strong hands locked on Rex's little forearm.
"Jay," Alex said, "go grab those 2 chunks of wood. I want to try something."
Rex finally managed a few words.
"I won't draw anymore." "It's too late for that,"
Alex said. He looked to his right.
Yeah, those are the ones. Put a chunk under his elbow, and the other one under his wrist.
Rex felt something hard shoved under his elbow, raising it a few inches off the leaf-scattered dirt. He watched Jay slide a piece of wood under his wrist, then looked up at the surprised face of Isaac Moses, who had yet to release his hold on Rex's arm. Isaac's mouth was always turned down, and his nose seemed too small for his face.
Oh, man, don't do this, Isaac said. That's going to hurt him bad.
Alex's smile faded. He looked hard at Isaac.
Shut up and keep holding him,
Alex said.
If you don't, you're next.
Isaac's mouth opened, perhaps to say something. Then he closed it and looked down. Alex took a step forward. His feet straddled Rex's elevated arm. Alex looked like a towering god, blonde hair hanging down, a few locks gleaming from the beams of late afternoon sun filtering through the tree's shade.
I have to teach you a lesson, Rex. I have to teach you about pain.
The tears flowed. Rex couldn't help it.
You guys hurt me all the time.
Alex's smile widened.
Oh, them was just love taps, faggot. You probably even liked it. Now you get to learn about real pain.
Alex weighed over 200 pounds. He was bigger than most of the teachers. He raised his leg knee high, letting his military boot hover above the center of Rex's forearm. Alex smiled, then stamped down hard. Rex heard a muffled crunch sound, then had the odd sensation of feeling his forearm grind into the dirt, while his wrist and elbow were still elevated a good 2 inches off the ground. Then came the pain. He looked before he cried out. His arm made a shallow V, an extra joint between his wrist and elbow. Oscar got off of Rex's chest. He stood there, black curls puffed out from under his hat. Oscar was part of the circle that surrounded Rex, the circle that blocked out what little sun filtered through the overhanging tree, the circle that cast the wounded boy in complete shadow. Tears streamed down Rex's cheeks, down his chin, washing through the blood that smeared his face. It hurt so bad. His arm, it bent where it wasn't supposed to bend. Alex put his foot on Rex's stomach.
Tell anyone about this and you're dead, Alex said. I know 100 places to hide a body in this city. You got me, you little faggot?
Overwhelmed with pain, humiliation, and helplessness, Rex just cried. No one was coming to help him. No one ever would. He wanted to hurt them. He wanted to kill them. A size 14 boot kicked him hard in the ribs.
I said, do you get me, Rex?
Thoughts of hatred and revenge vanished, replaced by the more powerful and ever-present fear.
Yeah!
Rex screamed, a mist of blood and tears flying off his lips.
Yeah, I hear you!
Alex lifted his big boot. Rex had time to close his eyes before the heel hit him in the face. Chapter 15. Chief Zhao's Office. When Brian and Pookie entered the chief's office, 4 people were already there. Chief Zhao sat behind her desk, her blue uniform free of the slightest hint of a wrinkle. Assistant Chief Sean Robertson stood a little behind her and a little to her left. To the right of the desk, in chairs against the wall, sat Jesse Sharrow, the Homicide Division Captain, and Assistant DA Jennifer Wills. Sharrow's perfectly pressed blues were a dark contrast to his bushy white eyebrows and slicked back white hair. Wills had her legs crossed, making her skirt look even shorter than it was. A black pump dangled provocatively from an extended toe. Zhao wasn't much for decoration. A big, dark wood desk dominated the room. Commendations hung on the walls, as did several framed pictures of Chief Zhao shaking hands with various police officers and elected officials. 2 of those pictures showed her with governors of California, both the current and the former. The room's largest photo showed Zhao shaking hands with a smiling Jason Collins, San Francisco's heartthrob of a mayor. Behind Zhao's chair, on angled wooden poles, hung the U.S. flag and the dark blue governor's flag.